We're here to welcome and learn from Dr. Eric Arabuo from Calvin University, who's a professor of computer science. Look forward to your talk. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. So only light topics in this session, isn't it? I first want to just acknowledge a mistake I've made. I forgot to include my partner's name on the slides, and that's my own mistake. But me and Fernando, we've been working together, and he's more like on the philosophical side of this discussion. I'm more like applied sciences, and you might be asking, like, what a computer scientist is doing here, like on a behavioral sciences track. Basically, I work with social computing, so I develop computational models of people's behaviors. And this is like one of the new projects I'm investing in now. And I hope you enjoy it. So I'm originally from Brazil. I work a lot with complex systems. I don't know if you know much about it, but we're going to talk a little bit about it today. Agent-based modeling, so that's kind of the way I develop my models, and today I basically want to share with you some computational modeling and what they can help us to understand and maybe even address. And in this case here, we're talking about the growing challenge of political polarization in Christian communities. So this is a topic that's very close to my heart, and I believe it's crucial for the future of our churches. So the first question that comes to mind is like, why study polarization in Christian communities? And I think the context is quite self-explanatory. We live in a time when political polarization is dividing communities, including our churches. And this is not just about politics, it's about how we relate to one another, how we worship, how we build community. And one major trend is they created an expression that doesn't exist in the English dictionary. It's the de-churching, where people, especially younger generations, they are leaving traditional church settings, and this reflects deeper changes in society and highlights the generational divides that shape our faith communities. Well, Brian Chappell, he just released a book a few months ago. I don't know if you had a chance to know about it, but he wrote this book, The Multigenerational Church Crisis, and he emphasizes the importance of understanding the perspectives and the experiences of different age groups to foster unity and collaboration within congregations. And he also points out that the de-churching process is not exclusive to younger generations, but also affects older generations, leading to a complex interplay of beliefs and practices within the church community. So one of the main contributions of the book, in my opinion, is this table here, where he kind of tries to draw the differences between the generations and how the differences they contribute to this polarization. So he basically works with the idea that the older generation have a perception that they were the majority, especially in the US, and that the younger generation, they basically see themselves as a minority. Another important aspect is that there is no social gain for young people to become Christians nowadays, as like 50 years ago, let's say. So he really encouraged like churches to embrace young people who are like very keen on following Christ and participating in the life of the community. And one of the interesting things in here is that like the concerns, the missions are different as well. While the older generation was very concerned about taking control of culture, we see that the new generation is more worried about like making credible their faith. And then there is like a parallel between the topics and how they approach. So like the older generation would try to bring how to a lot of topics, while the new generation is trying to help with. So these differences, they obviously cause some frictions, and they cause some changes in the way that the life of the church, let's say. So, even though recent research has shown that the church decline stabilized in the last years, I think some of you might have seen some new data coming out like in the past weeks telling that the the number of church members is stable. It also shows a division and a preference for different types of churches based on demographic factors such as age, gender, political affiliation. And this division is particularly pronounced among younger generations who are more likely to seek out churches that align with their values and beliefs. So there is a very interesting article on the Christianity Today talking about the younger generation going to church and the boys going to more Orthodox churches and the girls going more to the black wall churches and all those. So there is kind of a trend like that divides people and the kind of church they choose based on their demographics. So in this book here, Jim Davis and Michael Graham, they work with Ryan Burge, and Ryan Burge is the biggest data scientist on church demographics nowadays. He's a very good data scientist, and so they wrote this book, and they argue that the decline in church attendance is more than just numbers. It's a reflection of deeper shifts in values and community engagement. And one of the quotes is the talking about the early church, saying that the early church used it to cheerfully bring the poor and the destitute into their lives, now often serves them at a distance through benevolence programs without fully embracing them into their church family. So that's kind of a very nice portrait of, maybe some of you might be observing in your communities, I don't know, but it's kind of a trend in especially in the US. So Charles McDaniel Jr. also drawing, this is a paper he wrote on Tocqueville, and he has this very interesting reflection about Tocqueville's perception of American Christianity like more than a century ago. And he talks that the less religion and its ministers are mixed up with government, the more influential religious ideas will become. So he's basically claiming that, especially in American society, democracy thrives better when church is not on the way of politics and vice versa. It's like a debatable argument, but it kind of sheds light on some of the problems we're facing now. And it's a very interesting take that they have. And Dan White Jr. also wrote this book, Love Over Fear. And he gives a powerful definition of polarization that helps us to understand a little bit of what I'm talking about here today. So polarization takes people that have something in common, emphasizes their differences, hardens their difference into disgust, and turns their disgust into blatant hatred, shaping us for only two options, our side and their side. And that's kind of, I don't need to elaborate on this. He also shares some real life examples. So he's a pastor. And it's very interesting because he talks about like two families who left his church. One of them because his church was like too much leftist, and the other family because the church was too conservative. So he grieves like the fact that people feel threatened and they just can't cope anymore like with differences. And these insights, they help us to see the complexity of the problem and the urgent need for new approaches. We have some work on neuroscience and on social psychology as well. So Mark Iacoboni is like a very successful neuroscientist. He came up with the idea of the mirror neurons. So he kind of developed this idea that we mimic people, and that's how empathy happens between people as well. And we kind of derived from his work the fact that we influence each other unconsciously all the time. So social contagion is kind of something that happens willingly or not. And Carol Travis and Elliot Aronson, they are more like on the social psychology side. And they wrote this amazing book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's a fascinating book where she's gonna give us all sorts of examples of people who made huge mistakes that harmed like loads of people. And after they were found like in fault, like they never stepped back and apologized or said like I was wrong. Like judges who condemned people to life sentence. And after DNA was created, like they found out that the guy was not the criminals, and the judge was like, no, but I'm sure that this person is the right guy, and my sentence is not wrong. So these kind of things, they also play a role when we are like interacting with people in community, because Well, basically, there is this common understanding that our opinions, our beliefs, and our behaviors are not static, but rather dynamic and subjected to change. But we also know that to shift political opinions and even behaviors, like, it's not something that comes lightly. Apparently, we have some self-justification system playing a role in our brains all the time, and every time we are presented with facts that contradict our beliefs, we kind of we wrestle with that and we try to dismiss the evidence that, like, our beliefs or our behaviors are wrong. So that's kind of what plays a role in here. And social influences, media exposure, personal experiences, they play a role on this thing all the time. So this resistance can be driven by a variety of factors. And I named one, like, we have also cognitive biases, social pressures, emotional attachment to one's beliefs, and all sorts of things. So this is, like, very important to acknowledge also. Well, as Christians, we face a unique challenge. In the context of Christian communities, this resistance to change can be particularly pronounced. As individuals, they may feel like a strong sense of identity and belonging tied to their religious beliefs. And this can make it very difficult for them to engage with different perspectives or to consider alternative viewpoints. But fortunately, we are people of the Bible, and we take Jesus' words seriously, even when they seem like too naive or impractical in some sense. So it's I always go back to Matthew 5 when I'm thinking about this. Discussions, and Matthew is basically saying to love, like, the people you like is easy. Like, the hard part is, like, love your enemies and pray for them and just look at them like as your neighbor. So this is the message that Jesus left to us. And unfortunately, what we see in the church is, like, a completely different approach to this clashes and to these differences. So this teaching is radical. It asks us to move beyond comfort and embrace unity and compassion, even when it's difficult. And the question that stands here is, like, how do we do this in a polarized world? So this is where computational modeling comes in. I work with agent-based models. They are also known in some areas as individual-based models. They are called ABMs for short, and they allow us to simulate the behaviors and interactions of individuals in a community. And by modeling these interactions, we can see how small differences, they can grow into large-scale polarization. We call it emergence. So this is kind of what we see. We create agents, we give them small rules, we let them interact with each other, and we can't kind of beforehand, we can't predict what's going to happen in the macro level. By modeling these interactions, we can see, I've read this already, sorry about that. ABMs also let us test different interventions, like increasing tolerance or strengthening social ties, and see what might help build unity in our community. So those are some of the things that, like, you can run experiments in the computer that you might not be able to replicate in real life. And that's where, like, this technologies, they come very handy. So I will briefly describe the model I built. I use NetLogo as a tool for building agent-based models. So I just want you to imagine a church with 400 seats. Each member is represented as an agent. Each agent has four main characteristics. So they're going to have a political leaning. Every churchgoer is going to have a political leaning from progressive to conservative. And that's going to be represented as numbers because I'm a computer scientist and we like numbers. So it's going to be -1 to 1. Each individual is going to have a tolerance for political difference. So they have, like, a threshold. So, like, if they interact with someone who is drastically different, they're going to resist to build the relationship. This is what we call homophily in social sciences and in social psychology. Each individual is going to have an activity level, which is like a number from 0 to 1, which is kind of the probability that that person's gonna want to attend the service next Sunday. So if it's 1, the person's gonna be there. And if it's 0, the person basically left church. And the individual is gonna have an emotional state, which will reflect the individual's well-being. And this well-being is gonna be drawn from the relationships and from the interactions with people. So each week, these agents interact with one another. They form and evolve social ties based on who sits near them. So we have some geographical formation in here. And I took the liberty to build the church and assume that everyone sits on the same place because that's how I do it. And if someone sits on my spot on Sunday morning, I feel really angry and I just like, yeah. Anyways. So, and usually you interact with people who are around you, so you get to know them better, actually, because after service you stand and you have some chit-chat. So they are going to interact with one another. They form and evolve social ties based on who sits near them, how similar their politics are, how often they attend, and this creates a dynamical social network that changes over time. So the idea in here is that we're going to build a social network from that, and each agent is going to basically have this this flow of interaction. So every Sunday, they're going to decide if they're going to attend church or not, based on their activity level and emotional state. And those who attend will interact with others, prioritizing friends and neighbors, sometimes meeting new people. The quality of the interactions will depend on political similarity and tolerance. So like we have a homophily equation running through the model. So if people are more like alike, like they're gonna tend to bond together. After each interaction, members update their emotional state. Every time you go home after service, you reflect a little bit and you think about like how was it. Finally, the social network evolves. So strong ties, they tend to get stronger. Weak ties may fade and new connections can form. And the heart of the model is basically how the emotional states are updated. And I have a lot of differential equations, but I didn't want to bore you with those. So I just put one in here. And this is basically the emotional state of the person. And it's quite simple, actually. It has a baseline emotional state. And you add the positive connections, and you subtract the negative connections. That's basically how it goes. So if the balance is more pending towards the positive, the person's going to be more emotionally satisfied, and vice versa. So it's that's basically how it goes. So in simple terms, positive interactions with friends, they will boost well-being, while negative politically charged interactions reduce it. The model let us adjust how much friendships and political differences matter. So we can see what happens under different scenarios, so we can tweak these things as well and play with the model as we want. So this is basically how it looks like from the perspective of me, who is developing the model. So there you have the church, you have the two sides of the church with the seats, the front is the pulpit, and here we have basically just a bunch of statistics that we're interested in. We're very interested in knowing about how the network changes, if the ties are going to be breaking until like you have no community, or if clusters are going to be created and you're going to have just like two different churches inside one, and so on and so forth. So we kind of look at all these variables here, and like the red agents in there, they're like conservative, the blue agents are progressive, and you have different grades of that. And so sometimes members might leave the church in this model. So this can happen if their emotional state stays low, if they stop attending for several weeks, or if their activity level drops. When people leave, they will break all their social ties and disappear from the community, because that's normally how it happens. In one of the books I talked about, the Great De-Churching, there is a very specific group that they analyze, which is like the divorced people or the single moms, who basically like they leave church and they really break the ties because they don't feel that they belong in that community. And over time, we see the network self-organize, often with more political clustering and more departures, and especially when the tolerance is low. So what we learned from this model. And yes, I have 1 minute, but I'm the last one to talk. So our amazing moderator gave me 1 hour. No, I'm joking. I'm coming to an end. First, we learned that strong social ties help buffer against polarization. So when people have good friendships, they are less likely to leave, even if there are political differences. High tolerance also reduces departures and helps maintaining unity. The size of the community and its initial diversity affect how stable it is. Most importantly, the model let us test interventions, so we can increase the tolerance of people, or we can strengthen the friendships to see what might work in real life. Of course, like as any model, this model has its limitations as well. So this is a simplification. So it doesn't include, for instance, the theology, leadership, or outside events that affect church life. And in the future, I hope to add these features like leadership effects, belief change, interactions between multiple communities as well. Even so, the model gives us a useful framework for thinking about polarizations in church. To sum up, polarization in church emerges from the interaction of individual psychology, social networks, and community dynamics. Computational model or computational modeling helps us bridge the theory and the practice, offering insights for building unity in diverse communities. And I really hope that this work inspires new conversations and practical steps towards healing divisions in our churches. Thank you so much for your attention. And yes, I will be happy to take some questions.
Can you go ahead and call on people?
Yes, please, yeah.
Hey, thank you for a very interesting talk. Could you say a bit about how you incorporate diversity into your model, specifically? So you mentioned political diversity, but specifically racial diversity and economic diversity.
Yeah, so these two things are not part of the model yet, but every new attribute we want to include in the agents, they become like a variable. So each agent in our model is going to have, let's say, an economical status or like a race. And what happens after you include them is that you distribute the values among the population of your model according to some demographics. So for instance, if I'm like talking about a church, let's say in Texas, for instance, it's going to have a different political inclination and racial distribution than if it is a church in New York, for instance. So the nice thing is like it's the same model. You don't need to build a new model for each state. You just need to change the distribution of the variables. And usually like we use normal distribution, so we have like a mean, and it spreads like throughout that mean, because that's basically how statisticians like they work on that. Does that explain?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so I have a question. What data do you feed into the model to understand how humans actually interact?
Yeah.
Like, so where do you get your original data from?
Okay, so this is the kind of scientific approach that causes a lot of discomfort in a lot of scientists, especially if you're like very data-oriented, because this kind of simulation, you won't find data, like precise data about like a whole community and their political inclinations and all their ties over like years, because that's what you need basically to validate the model. So mostly I use data to kind of explain why I've made the decisions that, like why this rule like this. Like so for instance, the Great Dechurching is has like 2 pages of like data sources. I use a lot of them to kind of explain like why people behave the way they behave and why the distribution of the demographics is done like this. But like sometimes this kind of simulation doesn't have a way of being validated. And we validate it in literature, basically. So we read like the scholars on that specific area and see if their findings, like they converge to what the model is showing us. So it's a bit tricky, but like if we have data, we include it. It's totally easy to include the data in it. But this is the kind of experiment that's really difficult to recreate in real life also. It's, for instance, like evacuation in, like if a building is on fire, like you can just put fire on the building and just, you know. But the nice thing is that you can play like with them all in, as you wish. So it saves time and it saves like resources, I'd say. Does that explain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's already an enormous amount of data and for knowledge out there on polarization and also mitigating factors. It's not clear to me what this modeling brings to the table. Do you have a testable hypothesis you're going to use? Or?
How can I explain that? This kind of research, when we work with emergence behavior of populations, usually you let the simulation tells you what's happening. So mostly we are concerned about creating simple rules that are like very substantial and are referred by literature. And we replicate those agents. But what comes out of that is usually what we observe and draw from that. So we don't have a hypothesis. We basically build a scenario that looks like real world and we see what happens. The idea in here is basically to identify like interventions that can be done in church that can kind of contain the polarization in church. So we could, for instance, like think about the leadership of the church and what kind of preaching they're giving to the congregation. And we can simulate that and see how that influences people in a way that they build community instead of splitting up. So I don't know if it makes sense, but it's that's how this kind of research goes. We're interested in emergent behavior of populations. And sometimes like we don't even know what's going to happen because like we just build the rules for the simple agents and then we see what happens. It's very, yeah, it's very annoying for scientists, I know. Sorry, yeah.
I know you build this model for 400 people, but do you know if there is size matter, like small church versus large church? Like in population genomics says, different forces tend aggregates in small and big and large populations.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, yeah. So that's where we want to go. The thing is like this, I just started this work. I was hired by Calvin 1 year ago. So I was teaching in Brazil for 13 years in a secular university. And now people don't look me like as a weirdo when I do this kind of research. So, but yeah, the idea is that like this model is going to grow. And I want to get to the level where I have the network of communities as well and how they affect each other. Like, for instance, in Grand Rapids, we are facing now like a split in the CRC. I don't know if you're aware of that, over LGBT discussions on the theological side. And that's like a more like a macro phenomenon happening due to political polarization. So this is like the first model. I'm building like a whole research project on top of that. And the idea is that like as we grow, like with this model, I can build many different kinds of churches. I can reduce the amount of seats. I can add new members later. I can change the demographics of the members, but that's just the initial experiment. I'm sure that later, in the next ASA, I might bring a more like fine-tuned and a better model for discussion. Yeah. Yes.
Please. This is a really cool model that you're starting to develop. Have you thought about how like the boldness or the hospitality of the members might inform like how strong these connections are established and maybe how that might help people enter into the church or maybe play a role in like retention of the church or membership?
Yeah, I thought a lot about like including hospitality as one of the traits of the agents. But later I just consider that the threshold, the tolerance level, is somehow a way of measuring hospitality as well. Because if you're like very keen on just like getting to know people who are just like you, that's not hospitality, right? That's like, that's just a fake hospitality. So that's why I didn't add it, but it somehow it's there. Like the threshold like is kind of, the tolerance threshold is kind of a way of accounting for that.
It's been so fascinating. Thanks for a great discussion.
Absolutely,
let's give our speaker a hand.
Thank you.